This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not constitute legal, tax, investment, financial, or other advice. It is not intended to cause or induce breach of an existing agency agreement.
Hello?
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 This is the Vancouver Weather State Podcast.
And welcome back to Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Scalina.
And I'm your other host, Matt Scalina.
And welcome back to Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Scalina.
And I'm your other host, Matt Scalina.
And Matt, I should say host, but also realtors with Oakwind Realty in downtown Vancouver. And I am so, so excited for today. We've got Wendy Waters.
Wendy Waters, back by popular demand.
Yeah.
You might know her from her past life on Twitter.
Yeah.
Now you might know her from her life on LinkedIn.
Right.
No, but she's in all seriousness on LinkedIn now. I watch for a couple people, Brendan Augmentson being another
sure.
one, but Wendy Waters, I like her posts. She posts really insightful stuff and she makes comments that are really smart
time. I feel like there's a few people that we bring back on a regular basis. And of course, Wendy is one of them. Any chance we get, we'll have her on.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. And do we say her title?
No, Vice President of Research Services and Strategy at Great West Life Realty Advisors, or GWL.
Yeah, she's the person who's advising the big pension funds, all the smart money in Canada, where to invest real estate-wise.
Yeah, it's great talking to Wendy because she always comes with stats and insight into not only the residential market, but the commercial market. And
the rental market too.
And the rental market, and can always kind of place Vancouver in the broader context. Some really, really incredible takeaways today, including a stat that I had no idea about our office space, which kind of
blew
my socks off.
Stay tuned for that. But it is, now that you say it, it is interesting. This conversation, more so than a lot we've had lately, there's not a disconnect, but a differing perspectives. You know, we're boots on the ground.
Yes.
We're what you'd call the grunts, right? We're the grunts. And Wendy's, would you call her the general? She's got the bird's eye view of what's going on. So it's...
I call her Wendy.
Yeah. But that's what, enough. You know what? It's two differing perspectives. And it was kind of nice to get your head out of the foxhole to keep the analogy going. And
is this really happening?
Now we're
in a foxhole. I think let's get back to reality.
It is. The reality is it was good having Wendy's perspective on the show and a lot of fascinating takeaways. And she brings the data, which is always great.
Yeah. No, I loved having Wendy. Before we get to that, Matt.
Before we get to that, Adam, we have the MLA Newswire Weekly. This is a pre-sale update brought to you by the MLA Canada Advisory Team. The headline this week, new transit-oriented areas ripe for early investment.
Right.
So, Adam, what is a transit-oriented area, first of all?
So, yeah. So, TOA, as I call them.
Right. Where I think that's actually lingo.
It is used in the
industry.
They're out identified in Bill 47, released in 2023. The goal of the bill, Bill 47, is to increase density around rapid transit or key bus exchanges. Basically, that's what's going to help solve the housing crisis, right?
Right, and it matters because around SkyTrain and the Canada Line, we're going to see taller towers, more housing, and new opportunities for pre-sale investors. The way that I kind of see this is we're in the early days where 20 or 30 years from now, somebody's going to go, imagine if you got in on this area in the ground floor.
Totally. And that's the thing, right? With the higher towers, the increased density, the increased foot traffic, and then all of a sudden you have these amazing retail spaces and commercial services opportunities that arise in a given area. And then everywhere feels really walkable and great. And it also leads to advantages for investors.
Exactly. So transit-oriented developments have historically performed very well compared to the general market due to exactly what you're talking about.
Right.
Residents do not have to live close to work, can prioritize livability. And here's a question for you, Adam. For condo investors, how much more typically do you think rents are around SkyTrain? As opposed to, say, you know, let's call it 15 minutes away.
Interesting. That's actually a really, I'm guessing around, Well, maybe 10%.
You know what? You're bang on, and it's not because you had the notes from MLA. Rents are typically 5 to 15% higher near transit stations, providing better investment returns than comparable housing options that are not near SkyTrain.
I always go with the blended, but yeah, 5 to 15%.
This is like when Jaden Lee was here and he gave you the numbers before he asked the questions. If you liked what you heard today, subscribe to the MLA Newswire, a daily email roundup of the latest real estate news and market insights. Visit MLAcanada.com to subscribe now.
And Matt, this podcast is also sponsored by Scalina Real Estate, which is our real estate team in Vancouver. And I'm so excited because we've got a brand new listing that's going to be featured on VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. And this one's coming Monday.
2656 East 7th. Let me tell you a little bit about this house, Adam.
Nice pocket.
It's a residential area, super close to the SkyTrain.
Right.
Also close to all the new amenities that are being built right around Nanaimo and Broadway. The house is late 50s. Just a standard lot, 2,200 square feet, 5-bed, 3-bath, dialed house. You've seen it.
Yeah, super nice. I love those late 50s houses. But I mean, this thing really well built. Like you can tell the house is a tank, but then they've also done all the mechanical. Aesthetically, it's a really great looking house. And having that standard lot, really great backyard, south-facing backyard.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. Well, here, let me just list a couple things. Air conditioning.
Right.
Tankless hot water. 5-year-old furnace, new roof, new bathrooms, fully legalized suite, updated panel, 200 amp. It's like literally turnkey doesn't describe what this house is. I'm telling you.
I got to say you can't say that about every house in East Van.
You definitely can't. 2656 East 7th. You don't want to miss this one. Head over to VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com to see it on Monday. And while you're there, Adam, hit sell with us where you can download the sold plan.
Yeah, Matt, our most downloaded document to date, the sold plan is a step-by-step guide for getting top dollar for your home in the shortest amount of time. Basically, it's instructional, how to get it ready for market based on over a decade of experience selling hundreds
decade
of homes.
Plus, come on.
Almost 15 years. Jesus, yeah. Time flies. But here, that's what you actually, you got to check it out. It's really good. And it's something that we built out because people are asking for it.
Exactly. So, it's terrific.
Absolutely. But without further ado, let's cut to this conversation, Matt, with Wendy Waters. I love having Wendy in the studio, and this one does not disappoint.
Enjoy.
This podcast is sponsored by Marcon, a local family-owned and managed real estate development and construction company that's been around for nearly 4 decades. Marcon is not only committed to high-quality construction, but it also is making a positive impact in the communities in which it builds, all across the Lower Mainland.
We want to highlight two incredible Marcon projects. Elmwood, a 38-story tower located at Burquitlam's most important intersection, Como Lake Avenue and Clark Road. This landmark tower will feature 335 condominiums, over 37,000 square feet of office and retail space, and almost 20,000 square feet of amenity space. Elmwood has been incredibly popular with 80% sold currently, but they still have a great selection of junior 1-bedroom all the way to 3-bedroom homes remaining. Check out marcon.ca/elmwood for more.
And Matt, we are also excited about Soane House, Marcon's newest community in West Coquitlam, with 165 homes ranging from junior 1-beds to 3-beds. Soane House offers the perfect West Coast aesthetic with a more nuanced Nordic-inspired design. Register today at marcon.ca/soanehouse. That's S-O-E-N-H-A-U-S. Or you can learn more at marcon.ca or follow them at Instagram at Marcon Homes.
Marcon, building for life.
Okay, so we're here with Wendy Waters. She's the Vice President of Research Services and Strategy at GWL Realty Advisors. GWL is Great West Life.
Yes.
For the people that don't know.
The uninitiated.
The uninitiated. Wendy, can you maybe start by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, so I lead the research and strategy group at GWL Realty Advisors. I've been in that role for nearly 18 years. And prior to that, I was at Avis & Young, which is a local brokerage firm specializing in commercial real estate. And before that, I was in the dot-com boom and bust. And then I previously did a PhD in economic history. And so prior to that, I was in grad school and I did a bit of teaching at UBC before I left and went into the dot-com boom and bust and then ended up in real estate.
And remind me, the dot-com boom and bust, I think we've covered this before, but were you in research or what were you doing?
I was doing content management for what was basically an online business directory, like which now you would not need because Google is so magical. And there's so many other features, but at the time it was like an electronic version of a Yellow Pages that you could search in a variety of different
ways. For pets.com.
Yeah.
I still get calls from Yellow Pages.
Oh yeah, me too.
They still exist. Okay.
Yeah.
I think they only contact realtors. So
you might advertise with them, I guess. They're hoping.
We're easy targets.
Yeah, fair enough.
So Wendy, can you maybe start by just a general question? How's the market?
And also, actually, can I just, in 18 years, have you ever seen anything like this market?
Well, yeah, this is actually a big change that really the whole time I've been in real estate, we've been in an era of falling interest rates, cap rate compression, which means that values of income producing properties have been going up just on that basis. And that's done. That really, you know, interest rates went down as low as they could during COVID. Cap rates went down as low as they could. And so now we're in a time where interest rates are going up, where the, you know, the yields on income producing properties need to go up with them. So it's a bit of a headwind on values for institutions, but for anyone who has an income producing property. So probably a lot of your listeners might have, you know, a couple of rental units or something along those lines as well. And yeah, with the cost of borrowing going up. So it's definitely a different time period that we're entering where, you know, for income, you really need to be looking at what's going to drive higher rents, higher income, or NOI as we have it, where you're also trying to manage capital costs. So it's definitely we're in a more challenging market. For sure. And then, you know, the office, so there was a bit of an office super cycle of growth of office demand and how the office market worked from like the early 2000s to today, where basically anytime new supply got added, it got absorbed immediately. So we didn't really see a pronounced office market cycle, especially not in Toronto. Here we had a little mini one around the time of just after the Olympics where vacancy rates went up. So for office as well, it's certainly been we're in a new era where in some ways maybe back to times of the 80s and 90s, and there's been other economic cycles, office market cycles over history, but not in the 18 years I've been at Realty Advisors. We've been in a bit of a, you know, it's been a great space to be in, a good ride.
Yeah. Well, but a bull market.
Very much a good way to put it. Yeah, yeah. It's been a bull market.
I was actually listening back to one of our episodes that we did with a gentleman from the States years ago that we're actually going to release because it's all about real estate market cycles. And one thing that I was literally listening to it this morning, he was saying a real estate market generally takes about 18 years, which is kind of interesting. are you seeing this as the end of a real estate market or an economic cycle? Maybe it's the same thing. I'm just curious as to how you're thinking about it and also what that means for, say, the next, like, are you thinking, okay, end of era, we have the next 10 to 20 years looks totally different?
Hard to say on that. Certainly, I think we, you know, and there'll be different opinions on this. My opinion is, I think interest rates are only going to go up so high because of a lot of demographic pressures of baby boomers' demand for savings vehicles. It's going to keep certain types of rates low. Other people have different opinions,
sure.
But I think are we going back to the ultra low rates we had during COVID anytime soon? I don't think so. So I think we're in a different cycle. How long it will last, you know, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And it will be driven a lot by the economy as well, is how much growth we have. And, you know, population growth in Canada, which is, you know, one of the things I think we're going to talk about, that grows demand for real estate in a significant way. Mm-hmm. Obviously, every kind of real estate pretty much at some level comes back down to population because more people means they need to go grocery shopping. So food-anchored shopping centers grow in demand and they workplaces. So office spaces, you know, shopping also ties back to industrial demand. More housing ties back to, you know, the whole housing cycle, the construction, that's more industrial demand. So there's the population growth ties to a lot of this. So, you know, what's the cycle of population growth going to be is another question to ask if you're looking for real estate cycles.
When it just struck me because when you were talking about the market in general, it almost sounds like we're in this moment of price discovery again. Is that fair to say? Because I feel like in residential, certain sub-markets are still fairly active, but certain markets where there's a lot of inventory and inventory has obviously increased quite dramatically, you know, we are in a moment of kind of figuring out where prices are going. Do you feel that way in commercial as well?
Yeah, definitely in terms of the, you know, the bigger institutions and, you know, big portfolios of different asset types, how to value it. There's not a lot of trades. And then when there is a trade, it's sometimes got some distress on it or it's got some unique characteristic. I mean, in some ways, every building's unique, but it has something where you say, well, does that mean that what that traded for is a mark for the market?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it just the particular circumstances of that asset itself?
Right.
So yeah, there's definitely price discovery. It's partly it's kind of a self-perpetuating cycle of there's nervousness about buying because you don't know what the price should be. There's nervousness about valuing because you don't know what the price could be. And so it's a little bit of a hesitancy. You know, we're still seeing some trades. I think you are, you know, you're seeing it in the housing side as well.
Sure.
But it's definitely a more subdued, a little bit more cautious market, you know, and all across the board.
And in terms of timing, like I'm just thinking here, you know, I feel like if we go back a year, we were saying to people, was November the bottom? Was, you know, maybe even the year before, 2022 might have been like, was November the bottom? We've asked that question a number of times and it does feel like we had a pretty strong year last year and it seemed like we were getting over the hump. Doesn't feel that way now on the residential side, especially depending on submarkets and what we're talking about. But one bed condos, for instance, in certain areas are like, you can't give them away right now, it seems. Like how much longer, this is all to say, with one drop in interest rates and potentially another one coming in a couple of weeks, like how long do you see this playing out?
Seeing
like this kind of low sales volume, a lot of caution, price discovery, maybe even just in the residential side, but then the commercial side as well.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I have less expertise on the residential side, so you may have some views on this more than me, but it's hard to say. I think another, you know, one rate drop wasn't going to be enough.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think, you know, if you talk to people, Bank of Canada and other, you know, they all knew that. So I think we're going to need to see another one and another one. The other thing for Canada is that some of our rates, especially bond, you know, the 10-year bond, gets tied closely to the U.S., rates. So we're going to need to see the Americans drop rates potentially, I think, to see just things unstick a little bit for just confidence in where that's going. So how long is that going to take? You know, I read the various bank economists that spend their careers and all their time thinking about this. And, you know, certainly a lot of people that think it's going to be by the end of the year, we're going to see some more certainty or, you know, there's some rates drop and that should help. I think more as we get more trades, also as values get solidified, that will help to know what you should be paying. But also, can you sell something? Can you recycle capital? You know, trade out of one asset class into another if that's what you want to do. Like if you want to sell an industrial building and, you know, buy an apartment building, that there's some, you know, certainty of that you're getting the right values for everything.
It's interesting because we've been talking about the interest rate for so many years. And now I feel like we're talking about inventory because inventory has gone up so dramatically over the last few months. What is the story in commercial? Is it more still of a rate? Is it a rate story or have you seen inventory increase?
For office, we've got a lot of inventory. So maybe that's one place to start and to talk about. So office has very pronounced cycles. And I sort of touched on this at the beginning in that it's a very large asset class. I mean, you build here in Vancouver, we build 300,000, 400,000 square feet at a time. Leases are 10,000 to a couple hundred thousand square feet at a time. In Toronto, they're more like a million square feet buildings. So they're really large buildings. So what ends up happening is, you know, when vacancy rates got really low, which they did in sort of 2016, 2017, 2018, they got very low. Companies that wanted to expand, we were growing office jobs at this rate of about 5% a year, which is just a crazy level in Vancouver. Companies needed to expand. There was no space. They trigger as anchor tenants. The good covenant companies will trigger new supply to get built. They'll sign on as the anchors. Groups like us build, you know, Oxford built. There's, you know, a variety, West Bank and Allied built new space. So there's a lot of new space. So we had our new Vancouver Centre 2 is our new building that built during this cycle. But all of this new supply was built. a lot of it started to open during COVID. Everyone's gone home. And it gave an opportunity to rethink office space, what companies were using it or how they were using it. But cycles, typically, this is what happens. So now we build new space. It tends to come online, even in past market cycles. It comes online just as the economy goes soft.
Just as you don't need it.
And the new buildings typically fill up because they've got anchor tenants, but also they're new and they offer a different type of workplace. And so they'll fill up, but it's the older buildings, quite often they're what we call the older A class. They're not bad buildings. They're just a little bit older. They end up with the vacancy in these cycles. And then you need to wait for the economy to take off again to fill. Everything fills up again. And then we start again with low vacancy rates, which trigger another cycle. And in all of that, the old stuff, so we call the B and C class, that falls off the market. It gets redeveloped, it gets repurposed, something happens. So we've been in a very normal market cycle for office, but with a lot of new supply, and then add on changes to how we use office space. That's not just from not even that much about COVID. COVID just accelerated and put a magnifying glass on it. It's that we've gone from using desktop machines that were huge and monitors that were huge, and they took up a ton of, they took up a lot of space. We were printing everything, and even residential realty, you probably just got rid of the paper tray, the paper trail.
You've seen Matt's desk.
I was going to say also not quite. I was over getting documents signed last night.
There we go. Okay. And in the rest of the world, it was sort of very slow. It was a document heavy, so you need to store all that paper somewhere. And so what we've seen from about 2006 onward was slowly the amount of office space you needed per person that worked in it was going down. People switched to laptop machines. They switched to cell phones and not landlines. Landlines have a tether. Your desktop had a tether. Now you're using Wi-Fi on a, on a laptop, getting rid of paper. And the COVID really accelerated that. Like, most people learned how to use DocuSign.
Yeah.
Not everybody, as your experience shows. Fax machines, a little bit less of a thing. I know, not fully on the residential side. But in any event, we ended up with shrinking the amount of space you need per person. So all of this is happening while we're building new office space. As companies move, they are shrinking the amount of space they need per person because they don't need to store paper. Banks and banks of filing cabinets are gone. Mm-hmm. That's gone to cloud storage. Everything's in the cloud. The computers aren't taking up as much room. Desks don't have to be as big. The computers don't generate as much heat. You can have more people in a space. So companies using a lot less space per person, and that's been something. But it's been a long-term trend. It's just we really have noticed it with COVID because some of these things accelerated. We would have gotten here eventually, but our modeling suggests maybe 10 years from now, we would have gotten to this point where in terms of how much we've adapted to being digital and mobile. And we all did that because you had to.
Right.
In a week, in March of 2020, you had to learn how to work without seeing people in person and without paper.
And have we seen, because industrial's kind of been the crown jewel of the market in many ways. Is industrial, are we seeing more inventory?
Yeah, we've been building industrial. Vancouver is a tough market to build any real estate in, as you know, but industrial as well. So yeah, we've seen a growth in that. There was a big growth in demand, again, accelerated by some of the COVID trends of e-commerce picked up, and e-commerce generates more demand for warehouse space. Whereas a retail store, if you've got a lot of retail stores, you'll store some of your inventory in your retail spaces and some in warehouses. COVID also disrupted global supply chains. And so that had, that had an impact on going to this just-in-case model. There used to be something called the just-in-time model, where you didn't want to have too much of inventory. You didn't need that much real estate. You wanted just to get that right to your customer. You can imagine, maybe it's appliances for new development. You don't want them coming off the ship and sitting around in a warehouse for a month. You want them coming off and getting right there. Well, with all those COVID disruptions, it got to be this just-in-case model. We should, companies thinking we need more warehouse space to store, a few weeks, a few months' supply of whatever product it is that the market's relying on us for. So that added a demand for industrial real estate. It hit Calgary and Toronto even a little bit more than Vancouver, because those are big distribution centers for Western Canada, Eastern Canada, in terms of companies taking more space. And now, some are discovering, hey, the supply chain's working.
Yeah, it's back to
where. Do we need as much space, or do we overestimate how much space we needed for just in case? So we're seeing a few companies pull back across Western Canada or Toronto, and then just not quite as much demand growth because we just accelerated that demand growth for industrial through COVID, where you know, we like e-commerce kind of had a great shift up in terms of the penetration, how much people are using e-commerce, and it's kind of holding steady now. It's not really decreasing, but now we're done. Like we did again, 10 years of growth in 2 years,
right?
Or in two weeks, as the case may have been, right?
So if there's the like the story seems in office, there was that super cycle demand growth right up to COVID when a lot of it's coming online. COVID, I've actually never heard the just in case, but of course with supply chain issues that becomes a thing. Multifamily, because we saw this demand shocks for places to live kind of throughout the last decade and especially during COVID. I was just talking to somebody with a rental. It doesn't feel, you know, a property manager was saying, I usually carry 15 listings at this time. I now have 30. And there's not a lot of showings. What is your take on, I guess, the vacancy rate, the rental market, and the multifamily market?
Yeah. And I think the if I remember correctly, around COVID, it was what, about a year and a half, the rental market did about 23% roughly.
On the
price of rents for rents going up. Yeah,
the demand for rental product continues to be really strong. What our modeling has shown is that there's more demand in this market than there is supply of rental housing, any kind of housing. But when we see rents really go, it's because that imbalance is being accentuated. So we're suddenly seeing a stronger growth in demand than supply, much stronger. So the imbalance is getting worse. And when it's getting worse, that's when we see rents grow. So we had, you know, to the year end 2023 for the Metro Vancouver area, like 120,000 net new people. That's a lot of people when the long-term average is about 40.
Wow.
For 45,000, right? So we had a lot. Now, some of them are non-permanent residents. Some of them are permanent residents. You know, how it all nets out, obviously, there's people from domestically, from elsewhere in Canada moved into Vancouver, but more people actually left Vancouver during this time. But that's a lot of new people. And so we really saw through mid-year last year, I think there was a lot of pressure on the rents. We won't have the updated rents that go till June 30th. That's how the government tracks them for metro areas. It takes like 6 months before they release it, or this past year it was like 9 months. So for what just ended a few weeks ago, we do not know. I think it does feel like rent growth rates have softened a little bit from what I'm hearing across the market. They're still going up, but not to the same degree, which would suggest that maybe the population's not growing as fast as it did last year.
And sorry, that 120 was just for the year 2023.
Yes.
Do we have any numbers on like my migration, how much interprovincial migration or how many people are leaving BC?
Yeah, well, so on a net basis, up until through 22, we had a net growth of, it would be a few thousand a year net growth into BC or into Vancouver, sorry. Last year, it went negative. Okay. So interprovincial, I mean, going to other parts of Canada. So last year, it went to negative about 4,700. And there's probably still a flow very steady out. And this is the net basis. Obviously, there's still tens of thousands move in, tens of thousands leave. Mm-hmm. And it just, where does it net out? Historically, it's always just been tied to what's going on in Alberta. So when Alberta's in a slump, more people come here or stay here. And when there's better opportunities in Alberta or there's just good opportunities in Alberta, then there's more of a trend towards people moving there. So with the housing situation and maybe a bit more opportunities to remote work or there's more remote job opportunities, we're therefore seeing, I think, you know, an interest in being in Calgary.
So is that, so did I get this right? Is that, so a net of about 4,700 people a year that we're losing in BC?
That's losing from Vancouver which, yes, that's what I've pulled here. That's losing. So, and then, but that's just to other parts of Canada. There's also, we had a loss of 18,000 to other parts of British Columbia in the year then in 2023, which is the most recent year for like time for which we have stats.
But that so is unrelated to, I'm just thinking, okay, we have 120,000 people move in. We have net 4,500 move out of the province and 18,000 move to other places. So the city's still growing.
Completely. Like that was a net growth of 120,000 people between permanent residents, non-permanent residents. We're still growing. Yeah.
Okay, that makes sense.
So still growing. Okay.
So still
imagine it,
yeah, I was down at English Bay last night. It felt like we were still growing. Yeah,
yeah, it's like driving around the city feels like we're growing.
Exactly. You haven't noticed that it feels like, it doesn't feel like the place is empty by any means.
No.
And it's just a flow. And keep in mind that any of these domestic migrations that I'm talking about, these are just people who were permanent residents or citizens of Canada. So they could have moved here a year ago, mm-hmm. got their permanent residency, and then packed up and moved to, you know, Nanaimo, Kelowna, Calgary, right. wherever they went. So it's important to keep in mind in the narrative that it's not, say, people born in Vancouver who are leaving necessarily. I'm sure there's some of that. But it's also probably more likely it's actually younger people that have only been here a year or two. They're, you know, still at that stage in life where they're moving around a lot and they can say, okay, let's go try a new opportunity. So right. that's something to keep in mind is it's anyone who's got basically permanent residency in Canada, that's what's being counted. So you could be a citizen, you could be a non-citizen, you could have gotten your permanent residency yesterday, you could have gotten it 5 years ago, you could have been born here, counted exactly the same in right, domestic right. migration.
And just for the context for people listening, what would be like typical kind of pre-COVID numbers for net migration?
Net migration, so pre-COVID, we generally had a small amount of net into Vancouver from other parts of Canada. So a few thousand would net into Vancouver.
But that also presumably has to do with oil being down from about 2014 through...
Yes. Yeah.
Through to whenever.
Yeah. So we had, yeah. So, and that does, that was I think that was an impact of just when Alberta's booming, people from BC and including the Lower Mainland, there's opportunities there.
Right.
People go, you know, just anywhere in the world, people go where there's opportunities. And if they're struggling and they see a opportunity, they'll go try it out. Doesn't mm-hmm. mean they stay, but they'll certainly go try it out
right.
and see if it works for them. So, yeah. So we've seen, yeah. So pre-COVID, intra-provincial, so heading out to other provinces, had gone positive, but during the oil boom in Alberta, it tended to be flat or negative. So that was certainly the case. And then into other parts of BC, pretty much has always been a negative. So Vancouver's kind of the arrival city for British Columbia and one of the arrival cities for Canada. So people move from rest of Canada, other parts of the world, to Vancouver. And then they realize BC has a lot of really awesome places to live.
Right, yeah.
And that they and might be a better fit for them. And so that's long been a common thing. It's a few, you know, on a net basis, you know, it's a few thousand between, say, you know, 1,000 or 2,000 to 10,000 a year. I think it was 18 last year, but that was a very big year of just a lot of movement.
Right.
And that's normal.
Are there any other, I'm just saying, and this is maybe outside of what you usually do, I'm just curious, are there any other large cities, two large cities in Canada that have this interplay like Calgary and Vancouver have? Because now that you say that, it's like, I remember the 90s, I was in Calgary and it was booming. And you talk to people that were here in the 90s and people were leaving, yeah. right? And some people blame the NDP of the 90s, but I remember that Calgary was thriving. Like you actually, when you start charting that, it's pretty clear that there is this, whatever, this back and forth between those two cities. And they're not similar cities. In a lot of ways, they're like very different places, right? Like does any other two cities have that?
Well, I think Alberta, to some extent, you see it between Calgary and Toronto as well. Toronto just being a really large city, so there's a flow of people. You see it between Alberta and some of Atlantic Canada. So you can see the flow of when things are booming, people are moving to Alberta. When things are got quieter in Alberta, people moving back. COVID, I think, accelerated that move back.
Right.
Halifax had a really high, on a percentage basis, growth rate in sort of 2021, 22, 23.
Huh.
And certainly some of that was interprovincial from Alberta as well as Ontario. But Alberta's an interesting place. So there's an interplay with a lot of other cities. But I think, yeah, the relationship between Calgary and Vancouver, it's probably the strongest just one-on-one between the two of them. You know, Toronto has the same sort of relationship with almost every big city in Canada. People are moving back and forth
right.
between Toronto and Vancouver, Toronto and Calgary, Toronto and Montreal, Toronto and Halifax.
Mm-hmm. I'm just thinking like if it seems like the end of an era in a lot of ways, right? Like the end of Calgary being in the dumps, the end of the office supercycle in Vancouver, the end of low interest rates. Like when you're advising or talking to quote unquote smart money about Vancouver, like has the opinion shifted about the city in terms of the investment potential? Does it still make sense to be focused on Vancouver the way people were?
The short answer is yes. So when we're talking about Vancouver, Vancouver's a very stable market for real estate investments. Doesn't tend to go down. Sometimes it's expensive, but values tend to hold. For office, the vacancy rate's only about 11% only. I mean, it was like three, four before COVID, but that's the lowest in North America. So it's still the strongest office market in North America.
North America?
Yes.
Wow.
According to the various brokerage houses that track all of these. So there's
That's
still
unbelievable.
Yeah. So it's partly because we're so land constrained. It's hard to get hard to get projects off the ground. We have height restrictions. So, in another market, you build a 1 million square foot tower, you can build 350,000, maybe 500,000, unique case of the Post, the new Amazon headquarters where they've got the two towers and they're able to get 1 million feet in that one building. But Vancouver's also has more occupied space today in terms of office space than before the pandemic. So it's actually 1.7 million square feet more occupied than pre-pandemic, which is there's not that many markets where it's that strong of a growth in demand. So vacancy rates, you look at a percentage, that's a ratio that we actually then look at, well, what's occupied space looking like? And by occupied, I don't necessarily mean that everybody's back to the office and no one's working remotely ever. It's just somebody has that space under lease and they're using it. They don't have it for sublease. They're making use of it in some way, however they like to use it, but that's more occupied space. So, Calgary's seen a turnaround in the last couple of years, but there's not more occupied space than 2019, but there's more occupied space than 2021. So that's a good news story for that market. But yeah, so for Vancouver, land constraints, industrial, there's a port, that asset class, interest in owning industrial. There's still interest, international interest in owning Vancouver office. Two buildings on Georgia Street traded to a German entity earlier this year as an example. So international money interested in Vancouver. Domestic money just partly is just figuring out what's the right price to pay and balancing it out. And obviously the housing situation here, people like to live here. So there's a lot of interest in building more housing and being a part of building housing, investing in housing in this market, because feeling like it will get absorbed, especially rental product and new rental product. A lot of interest in having that just because, sort of mentioned earlier, you want to be able to see potential for some rent growth and NOI growth. You don't want to have CapEx, having to replace roofs and the rest of your building infrastructure a year after you buy something. So if it's brand new, you develop, there's sometimes a development yield, plus there's the fact that you should be done once you're done on CapEx for a little while and you're able to just keep collecting rents.
In terms of, we had someone on the program who they were saying by the time that they've invested in the market rental building, the pro forma numbers the actual rents when it's completed almost always exceed what the pro forma was for the rents. So they love this market, and it's they're from out east. Is that still going to be the case? And I'm just the reason I ask that is because I think about the amount of market rental being built right now. And I mean, I feel like a lot of the developers in the city have pivoted and they're moving towards developers. I also feel like the rental market right now is pretty soft.
And
a lot more inventory on the market.
In relation to what it was.
Do you see that shifting in terms of are we going into a period of rent stabilization, or are we actually seeing rents decrease?
I don't think we're seeing it decrease. Certainly our buildings were not generally. I mean, there's probably some cases where something leased at a time like a year ago when there was just really, really intense demand.
Yeah, like the astronomical.
Maybe we're off, a tiny, tiny bit. But generally, rent's going up. Depends where in the market. Went on a tour in Surrey of a brand new rental in Surrey last week. And let's just say it's not my place to say what they told me the rents were. They were more than what we would have estimated for that market, considerably more.
Wow.
So I think there's lots of rental being built throughout this market, to your point. That is helping take the pressure off a little bit. I think what we're seeing is a slower rent growth rate, not necessarily declining rents. Some of the stats, a rentals.ca or some of those might show declining rents just because they tend to be biased by whatever's leasing up. So if you got a brand new building leasing up, it looks like rents are higher. And then once that's done, now it's the existing market rents that are out there.
Right.
It's in older buildings and so forth. So, you kind of, to try and look at same store, like that unit, what's it, if it comes, if it's relatively new, so it doesn't need a lot of capital change, what's happening to, you know, capital upgrades, what's happening to it, you know, those I think are still modestly going up. And that's back to, like, I think that's a sign that we're not seeing as much population pressure as we did a year ago, just by the fact these have edged down. New projects completing has been fantastic. Projects completing in the suburbs like Surrey on transit. So now you have a choice. Do you want to pay downtown Vancouver or Mount Pleasant rents, or you could be in Surrey for less in also in a new building? So there's, it gives, when people have choice, then it does help from a renter's perspective, it does help stabilize the rents. From our perspective on, we're always fairly conservative on our pro formas. So I suspect that anything new that we're going to launch today, that we're probably still going to beat pro forma because we try to stay conservative on those. But I also know there's some developers getting much more aggressive on what their pro forma rents are. Like I've seen some where I wonder. And that location, I know what we're getting in some prime locations where we have some, and I do wonder. So saying something can beat pro forma, it just depends on what number you decide
to go with. Right, how conservative or aggressive you are.
Yeah, and obviously we try to make sure, we're trying to protect for downside risk, managing pension fund money. So making sure that we're able to justify that, the number. And so we, you know, there's a lot of research. My team does research and modeling and where do we think it's going to be? And there's a range and we might go with the lower end of what our projected range is. Mm-hmm. If we were going to make some predictions on a pro forma of what are the rents going to be? What's the inflation rate on rents for 5-6 years out? Because it can take that long from the time you start the city process to the time that you welcome your first new resident. And we do have to we look at that and I said, we'll take probably the more conservative end of our forecast, even though we might say, yeah, there's a pretty good upside here, but we're going to officially go with the lower number.
Hey, everyone. Pardon the interruption. We just want to take a quick minute to thank the following sponsors who make this show possible.
This podcast is sponsored by Common Ground Consulting.
Are you developing in the Lower Mainland? Common Ground Consulting is a development management and consulting company with experience in single family, townhouses, multifamily, and commercial developments.
What I love about Common Ground, Adam, is they manage the whole development process, from due diligence and feasibility reports for initial purchase of land to completing rezoning, development permits, and building permits.
They streamline the whole process with strong relationships with sub-consultants and municipalities and a deep understanding of all city requirements.
Common Ground Consulting. Feasibility and efficiency prioritized every step of the way.
Learn more at commonground-consulting.com or 604-807-6419.
We are also sponsored by Oakwin Realty. This is our real estate brokerage, best brokerage in the city, hands down. If you are in the industry, a new agent, an aspiring agent, somebody just looking to make a change, new culture, new energy, new resources, head over to oakwin.com/join, type in VRP 2020. That's oakwin.com/join, type in VRP 2020. Not only do you get to meet Michael Morgan and the gang, the bigwigs over at Oakwin, you get a huge incentive for first going to oakwin.com/join, typing in VRP 2020.
I guess in the multifamily space, this may not have as much impact, but I'm wondering how you're thinking about the new Residential Tenancy Act changes that were enacted this past week. I think there's a huge impact on as realtors
selling
tenanted properties because now there's a 4-month. That's kind of the one that everyone's talking about in our world. But does that have an impact on the multifamily purpose-built rental market? Is it just like, man, just more of the same or more regulation, this is getting too much, or what? How is it being thought of?
And I just maybe because I think we're hearing anecdotal, like mom and pop, a lot of mom and pop investors are saying, I'd rather invest in somewhere like Alberta, right? Where that market's doing well, but also where the Tenancy Act favors or is a bit more balanced.
Yeah. So obviously the new Tenancy Act rule you've got is how much time for someone to take personal possession of what's currently a rental suite, and it's a lot, it's longer, and now there's an official form that you fill out and that. So I saw the memo. For us, because we're managing purpose-built rental.
Yeah, nobody's moving in.
It doesn't matter.
Right.
Because it is tough on renters to be in product that's not stable. you know, it's generally been a benefit to us that when we open a new building, you will get people moving out of condos in the area. In this is across the country. We notice this into our new building because the tenure is secure.
Yeah.
And especially in, say, BC and Ontario, where there's rent controls for existing tenants, if you're a tenant, that's, well, actually in Ontario, not for new buildings. But if you can move into a rent-controlled building, then you know your rents can only go up by CPI or CPI plus a little bit in BC, whatever the province decides to set it at. So yeah, so I would say that part is not affecting us. There's lots of regulations around new rental developments, and you've probably bumped into them if you've been working Broadway Corridor, which a lot of residential realtors have, of having to find homes for these, if you have to displace any renters, there's a lot of rules, and those can become very challenging for not just us, but the whole industry of trying to find a way to make the pro forma work, because we all know we need new housing. And as much as you're seeing a switch to rental, it's not nearly enough. I mean, in the last 10 years, we added 191,000 more people in the age group of 20 to 34. That's a prime renter age group. And we only added a net growth of 16,000 purpose-built rental units. This is in the metro area of Vancouver. Mm-hmm. So I don't have a calculator in front of me, but we're looking at, unless people want to live in a household of 13, something in that range, we're not building enough. And obviously some are living in condos, some are living in basement suites, some are living in overcrowded housing, you know, six people to a one bedroom, whatever they're doing, but we're not building enough housing. So even with a slight moderate uptick we've got in switching some product from condo to rental, it's not nearly enough to meet the market and to provide that secure housing for people that want to rent, don't want to be displaced, while they're busy at their job and everything else going on in their life because the owner wants to come.
Yeah.
The owner wants to move back in. So yeah, so we are still, don't have enough rental. The condo picks up the slack. The ideal thing would be more of the condo supply is an owner-occupied opportunity, a first-time buyer opportunity, a move-up buyer, maybe from a one-bedroom to a two-and-den or to a different neighborhood, that would be the more ideal situation. Would be that that's what it's supplying, as opposed to supplying so much rental stock owned by individuals. You know, some are great landlords, some are not sure what they're doing, some have older condos that really need some upgrades. So that's what I think we really do need to see, just as a society. We need to see more purpose built rental get built, because we didn't build it. Nobody built it for 20 plus years.
Right.
Switched everything, went to condo for the longest time.
And so do we see that? I mean, is this like a 10-year outlook where we see those numbers kind of balancing out? Or how long is it going to take? Or is it just really softening the blow a little bit every decade? Like, do we get there where we actually are balanced?
I think it's really hard. I think the provincial government, to give them credit, is trying in terms of some targets based on a wide variety of features, including what they think is pent-up demand in these markets. The provincial government mandating housing approval targets in the different municipalities. So that will help. But it is, Vancouver is probably never going to be in a perfect balance situation, because you're always going to have some pent up household formation, pent up demand, people live with their parents longer because that's a cheaper thing to do, you live with roommates for longer because that's a better option, cheaper thing to do. It's I don't know that Vancouver's ever going to get to this super affordability that you might get in some other markets, just simply because of the land constraints. But will it get better? It's a 10 plus years. Like, the CMHC has their report on, how many millions of houses or homes we need across Canada. What do we need in BC? And that's just to meet the current demand plus the new demand we're expecting. It's not going to get us, that's to get back to what was affordability of levels of a few years ago. It's not even getting us to something what someone from outside of Vancouver might consider affordable. Right now we just need a lot just to stop it from getting worse. So, and I don't have an exact number, because that's certainly need to take into account, condo and other kinds of housing. We track rental, but we think we're undersupplied of purpose-built rental by somewhere between 40 and 60,000 units in this market. So that's including people who would really much rather be renting from a purpose-built rental rather than a private landlord in a condo. That's the number of people that are living in overcrowded housing, and just, more people coming, the people, you know, back to that stat I gave of just how many 20 to 34-year-olds there are in this market who would, if given an opportunity, might be in their own place rather than with roommates, rather than with parents.
I'm literally just thinking out loud here, and I know you're not in the head of Ravi Kalan or David Eby or anyone, but I'm just thinking, like, the new tenancy rules make it really unappealing for a lot of people that are landlords right now or potentially aspiring landlords, because, like, if you think about it, you know, a rate hold is typically 3 months. You have to give 4 months notice. So mortgage brokers are saying, like, we can't even hold rates for as long. Like, it doesn't really make sense. Most people shopping right now aren't looking for, you know, if it's, we're in July. So what, it's August, September, October, November, you're December. Like, nobody's shopping for a Christmas home right now, right? So it's going to really impact tenanted properties from being marketable, and potentially there's going to be price differences amongst, like, vacant or owner-occupied homes. But so it doesn't make a lot of sense. And it doesn't make a lot of sense if you're trying to get people to invest in pre-construction, right? Because unless there's those people that are like, hey, I want to move from a one-bedroom to two-bedroom 3 years from now, like, it mostly investors are the ones that, you know, get those numbers to where buildings can be financed. Yeah. But I'm just thinking out loud here, like, maybe is this, like, disregard for that entire process that's worked for a while, or at least led to new homes being constructed. Like, is it disincentivizing that kind of model to move towards purpose built in some way? Or am I sounding like I got a tinfoil hat on? But I mean, it just seems like they've, like, from any sort of, like, new condo construction or investor activity, it's like, man, this just doesn't seem to make sense in any regard. Like, it's more protections, but it's just doesn't make sense.
Well, yeah. And I think that's the unintended consequences of, you know, well-meaning policies. So wanting to give people a little extra time, or they're trying to avoid bad faith evictions.
Right.
Where really at the end of the day, the provincial government's concerned about someone saying they're going to move in, but then not just so they can get the rents up to market because of turnover. So
At
the end of the day, a lot of our solution is we need more supply so that we aren't in these situations where there's these big gaps. But, and you've got, you know, individual owners of a condo might have their mortgage coming up for refinancing. They bought, you know, the last time they did a mortgage, the mortgage rates were what, 2%? And today, 6, 5, if you're lucky. And so they're going to be underwater every month on their payments. So they're trying to find ways to do this. So that, you know, obviously just that structure in and of itself is a challenge. And then I agree, you know, the government, so it's well-meaning, they're trying to figure out how to make things more stable from bad faith, what they would call bad faith evictions. Mm-hmm. But the end result is it's going to start to have that unintended consequence of discouraging investors, even more than they already are discouraged right now because of interest rates, from buying one or two investor-owned units, which is what we need to trigger, you know, get the pre-sales to trigger construction financing to get something off the ground.
Right.
And definitely, you know, you may or may not know, I'm on the UDI BC board now as well. And what I'm, you know, I hear in that room is how hard it is to get your pre-sales by the date you need to.
Yeah, sure. There's that to launch. Shot clock there. Yeah.
And we have a housing shortage. So suddenly projects are getting delayed or at risk of not making it. So we definitely need to be thinking about these individual investors who are buying condos, and how do we make sure that it still works for them, still works for renters, because it's still rental housing supply. Yeah. And I don't know what the solution to that is, but I think there certainly could be an opportunity to get some people in a room to figure this out. What's the right number? Because you say the 3 month hold on a mortgage opportunity.
That seems like such a glaring oversight, right? Doesn't it? Like
the rate hold for 90 days.
It's literally, they just don't, it's like, how does this work now?
Yeah, and that's the unintended consequence. And I, what we can hope, and certainly we've seen a little more listening from policymakers, or actually considerable more listening to what the consequences are of some things, that sometimes you just try something, it's not working, we'll revisit it and figure out another way to achieve our objectives.
Right.
Objective, penalties for bad faith evictions. Can we figure that out? Right. Versus doing this where you're stopping a turnover of homes and you're stopping first-time buyers. Like the affordable ownership opportunities are typically these old condos that are at least 5-10 years old. Mm-hmm. Like you tell me, what are you getting first-time buyers? Is that what they're looking for? And they kind of need to move in.
That's exactly it, right? Those are the people where you're like, are you thinking next January is a...
You want to move at Christmas, yeah. Because right now, if you've got to move a tenant along, unless they're prepared to potentially see if the tenant's open to some financial compensation to move earlier right. or something
but
like that.
But then it just gums up the whole... Like, there's just not certainty. And the market needs that certainty or wants that certainty, that's for sure.
Yeah, and I think that might be just things to document is, okay, this is now what... The government or even condo developers aren't, you know, condo developers may start to see the unintended consequence of even harder to get pre-sales. But then there's a whole other group that may see the unintended consequence of first-time buyers not being able to get into the market because they can't pull all these levers together.
Right.
And that might be a powerful argument to policymakers. Because it's affordable. It's the affordable ownership product. And if we could get those people to move on from rental, now we're vacating a rental suite for somebody else who needs a rental suite. So someone who's at the point where they can afford to buy a 2-bedroom condo in Burnaby, Wien's 10 years old. Well, we need them to move out of wherever it is they are. Now somebody else can go there. So it's gumming up the entire ecosystem if that's what's going to be happening.
Going back to the tinfoil hat thing, it wasn't because I was on the prize of more purpose built. So they kind of just, they were like, this doesn't impact that. It totally two unrelated things. And I'm just.
But then it also kind of moves us more to like the commercial model of like buying out tenants, which I think is even more of a Wild West, less regulated way to do things.
Oh, it's
like
insane.
The most I've seen, I think on the West Side, there was a tenancy buyout for $67,000 to the tenant to leave the home, which I mean, you can imagine, right? So I'm not saying that that's going to be a new norm, but you can imagine now. There's going to have to be a negotiation between a landlord and a tenant where...
But it's even down to like, you can't... When does that even happen? It's like, does a seller or a landlord seller needs a subject after the subjects are removed to make sure they can actually provide vacant possession through a buyout? Like, you don't buy them out when it's not a firm deal.
Well, I know, but I am hearing a lot more about mutual tenants or mutual agreements to end tenancy, which I think is a... It's not a way to move forward.
Yeah, that's not a useful...
Well, it's the need for certainty. And the need for certainty, I mean, the other side where we do see something like this is if we buy an older apartment that has a lot of excess density on the site, the old apartment has reached the end of its useful life, but there's still people living, or it's nearly there. There's still people living in it, needing to, obviously, we need to find them new homes. We need to give them the right to return. So there's a lot of pieces like that that... slow down new construction. And now we're finally getting some more density on sites that don't already have renters. But for a while, the only place you could build new rental was where there was old rental. So we had this displacement. But yeah, the rules around that, so very well-meaning, well-intentioned, but they can be very expensive. They can hurt pro formas and they are time-consuming to get everybody, into appropriate housing while you're building, figure out who's going to come back, what's the cost of that, of having people come back at their old rents in a brand new building. That's one of the challenges that our industry faces that is somewhat similar to what you're talking about is what to do with, there's just such a housing shortage that you end up in these crunches where now we're adding policies like that to try to make sure we're looking after renters, which is, I said, a noble idea, a great idea, but the unintended consequences of slowing down more housing and how much better would we be if we just had enough housing? If vacancy rates were closer to 3%, if you could add in the shadow market like condo and basement suites, well, then it would be less of a problem. It'd be much easier to move someone along because a buyer might even be able to say, hey, actually, I know of another place. Would you consider going there? Or a realtor might be able to help move things along by knowing about another place. Mm-hmm. But because there's nothing available, we're just all stuck.
Right.
And that's creating costs. It's creating new policies that are sometimes helpful, but sometimes have unintended consequences.
So I guess some things stay the same. But one thing that strikes me here is like, we started talking in the conversation about all the differences of the last year or two, like
you know, the end of a cycle, the end of this COVID kind of, there seems like there's a clear delineation. You know, when we look back at this 2022, say, we'll be like, okay, that was when something new started. Mm-hmm. And yet, like, if we were talking about this 5 years ago, what we just talked about, we'd be talking about, okay, there's going to be more demand shocks, right? Like, they're just, once the everything falls into line, we're going to see, you know, go through these periods of wild price appreciation because we're just not, we don't have enough housing, wild rent appreciation. Just wondering how or if at all people on your side of the business are thinking about that. Is that like still, you know what, this is actually a good environment to invest in because of all these challenges, even with higher interest rates and all these challenges on the other side?
Well, I think we're getting supply. Population growth is still going to be above the long-term average. We're getting more rental supply, but we're not getting more condo supply. We need everything. We need all kinds of housing. One of the challenges that we're having from an investor perspective is turnover. So in this market, and Toronto is another one where you can only set rents to market when somebody moves on. The fact that everybody is stuck means that the turnover rates have dropped from, like in Calgary, they're between 30, and Edmonton, they're 30 to 40% a year. So rent 30 to 40% of renters every year, and this is in the Yardi data, move on.
Yeah.
And in Vancouver and Toronto, it's getting down to like 10, 12% move on. And so—
That's not good for anyone.
It's not good for anyone. You know, they're not getting turnover. It means you don't have a chance to up, you know, to just fix a unit.
Right.
You know, as well as from an investments perspective, move those rents to market. Rent control levels at 2 to 3%. Inflation was running at 8%. Construction, a lot of the inflation involved and components involved in capital expenses on buildings is still running more in the 6 to 8% range. So utility bills, insurance, all of that is going up way more than 3% a year. So rents are being held at 2 to 3%.
And people are stuck. Right? Like, that's the other thing.
People
like
are stuck.
It's like arrested development in some ways. You're like, like literally you're like, oh, I'm still in that one bedroom that I got 15 years ago, but I can't, I'm not giving this up. And it's like, you shouldn't be in a one bed anymore.
You shouldn't be in one bed. Or we also have, you know, a situation where we've got a lot of people with relatively high income. So we're looking, we track the size of the market making over $125,000 a year, and that's household. So it could be two people, could be one person. And there's about five of those households for every one new purpose-built rental building that's built in the last unit that was built in the last year. This is the city of Vancouver, not the metro area now. So city of Vancouver. So we got about five households who make over 125K for every one new purpose-built rental unit. So these are people who can afford it. So they can afford the rents of these new buildings based on that one, you know, 30, one third of your income,
sure.
that metric. So there is a situation where, again, people are stuck. They're now they're staying in product that's traditionally more affordable. Mm-hmm. The older rental used to be the affordable rental. And as you made more money, you moved up to nicer rental, and then you might have moved into ownership. And now the interest rates are higher, so you can't move to ownership. And there's nothing to move into, so you can't upgrade what your living situation is. And then the rents have moved so much in all of this time that then it starts to be, well,
yeah,
do I
it's
even
just
want
so
to,
jarring.
Or I just stay where I am.
We've kept you, Wendy, for almost an hour here. It's about 40 degrees in the studio. Maybe as a final question, what is the biggest risk in your mind facing the Vancouver real estate market?
I think biggest risk is just being able to add that housing. So, and it's for all the real estate types. So just being, again, we've got everybody stuck. So being able to add housing, and at this point, you know, it needs to be sort of attainable housing. So we're most primarily talking about condo and purpose-built rental, and being able to get enough of that built and built fast enough. So getting those approvals moving, getting product built, getting people into it, getting the market moving. And this affects our, you know, demand for office. You know, if companies who are looking to open up operations in Vancouver don't feel like there's enough housing, it's getting too tight, will they come? Will they start to lose employees to other markets? In which case, you know, that could have an impact on office. People spending a lot more money on housing than they should. That affects retail. So we also invest in grocery anchored retail. It affects industrial. So it affects everything. Mm-hmm. It all starts with the ability to build housing. So that's the biggest risk I see in this market is getting housing approvals done faster, finding ways to build it, finding the people, finding the trades. I mean, there's all these other pieces of it, but right. We need to build more housing and get it done faster.
We have this segment called the Five Wire, five lighthearted questions that we end every show. Can you stick around for that?
Sure.
Okay, first question is one book that you've read recently that you would recommend.
I've been rereading 1984 by George Orwell.
Oh, that's come up a few times.
And I've tried to get my kid to read it and she seems to not understand that it's not really about farm animals.
Well, this, that was Animal Farm.
Oh, but, sorry.
So I said 1984. That. But 1984, just in terms of...
wrong book.
Wrong book. Okay, yeah. 1984. It's interesting in terms of rewriting the truth. It's right. A story from like the 40s about rewriting the truth and what could be happening with that. And since we are in a world where there's a lot of rewriting of truth by certain groups,
Big Brother.
It's a really interesting take on
Matt,
like,
let's
dystopian.
See, I'm just
trying to prove that I know what 1984, I have read it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Question number two.
In the last few years, Wendy, what new belief, behavior, or habit has most improved your life?
In the last few years,
I can't get over the Animal Farm.
Yeah.
Were you thinking Charlotte's Web or Animal Farm?
No, it's literally, I was trying to get her to read it the other day. So George Orwell kind of popped in my head. You're like, actually, it's Aldous Huxley. No, it's George Orwell. Anyway.
All right. Habit. I think I'll go back to during COVID, I took up doing yoga.
Oh,
morning,
nice.
And I'm still doing that. Oh, and I fantastic. Find that to be really good for, you know, physically, but also just taking that sort of mental break first thing in the morning and just pause and get away from screens and get away from bad news and rewritten truths and all of that. And just focus on one thing. So I'll put yoga.
Do you do hot yoga? Because then this room might be bearable.
Yeah. No, I do it outside. We have an old house and it has a like an old sleeping porch up high. So it's an old little deck out high.
Nice.
So
nice.
I usually go out there.
And do you actually feel like presumably you're more flexible, but that's got to be a big improvement on life.
Well, one of the reasons I need to do it was I had a once a week workout with a personal trainer and we did stretching at the end. And once COVID hit, I couldn't do that. And I just like, I was needing to stretch at that age where I needed to stretch. So that's the main reason I started it is, it's definitely better.
Perfect. Question number three, what have you been binge watching lately or a movie recommendation?
Well, I haven't had a lot of time to watch TV the last few months, but we've been working our way through the Americans series, which I never saw when it first came out.
Oh, yeah.
So I don't know if that's binge watching, but trying to watch an episode a week. And so again, sort of 1980s Cold War take. But
it's supposed to be so great, right?
It's a really good series. Yeah. So far, I think we're through season two. I think there were seven seasons, so we got a little bit to go. But Kerry Russell in there. And so the Americans.
That's great.
Favorite band or music right now? Not of all time. Because you've been on the show. You are a past guest fan favorite.
Yeah.
We need to timestamp this.
Favorite music. Not really coming up with one right now. I said, I wish I had more time to listen to music, but I do not. So I tend to just put on whatever, you know, some streaming channel and just listen to it.
Fair enough.
I think I'm going to have to just take a pass on that one.
All right. The pass. Something in this final question, something that you have purchased for under $1,500 that has had a positive impact on your life.
I think I'm going to go with the Apple Watch. Hopefully I didn't use that last time. The Apple Watch, just I never thought I would like having one. It's the health and fitness apps, but also you can set what you want to be alerted to.
Right.
And I actually find it actually allows me to sort of be away from the phone more because I know I'll be alerted if there's something I need to know about. So I find
never thought of it that way.
Interesting. Like if you know your kids are trying to text you, you'll see it on your watch, so you don't have to be having the
you
phone
can actually
right
put
there.
Certain number like certain specific numbers that can
I
get through.
I think you can. I just let any text through. I don't get that many, or just in Teams meetings or starting with work, it'll show up on here and on the watch. And so if I'm kind of not paying attention to the time, I get this buzz on my watch that you're supposed to be somewhere. So, So I think the Apple Watch, I didn't expect I would like it as much as I did. But
that's a great one.
Yeah. Fantastic.
And everyone in this room is wearing one. So I think we all
The only question is, do you sleep with your Apple Watch on?
I usually start it charging when I go to bed and then I always wake up in the night and I put it on. So I use its alarm function, which is really good for not waking up the other person in the bed.
I don't know if you tried that. Yeah, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
No.
It just vibrates on your wrist.
And that's enough to wake you up? Oh yeah.
But it's gentle still. Gentle, but you don't sleep through it.
Yeah, because it just keeps going, and all of a sudden, even if you're in a really deep sleep, eventually you wake up. Yeah.
Perfect. Well, Wendy, how can people find out what you're up to and more about GWL Realty Advisors?
Well, for what I'm up to, you can go, I think I post on LinkedIn usually a couple times a week, some charts. So you can look up my name on LinkedIn.com. So look up Wendy Waters there. You can go to GWLRA.com. That's our company website. There's a research section there. We haven't posted anything that recently, but we've got a few things in the works. So better to look on LinkedIn if you're looking for recent, but there's a lot of good papers from, you know, myself, Antheo Yuen as well on there, which people might find interesting. Anthea often writes on, you know, interest rates, inflation, IRRs on investment products. So some of your listeners might find that really interesting.
Are you part of the migration from X to LinkedIn? I feel like a lot of people
used to be big on X.
Yeah, when it was Twitter.
Right.
Yeah. And I was getting, when it changed ownership, I didn't really like the new owner. And then I was getting a bit disillusioned because the frustrating thing on Twitter is you get so many eggheads, you know, people without, they're using their real name, attacking, or just, it can be a very toxic environment.
Right.
And so LinkedIn, everyone's using their real name and professional identity. So I found the constructive dialogue is much better there because you know who everybody is, and you just get, and there are people, you know, there's disagreements, there's good discussion, but it's all in a very professional context.
Right.
So I like it better.
Right.
Excellent.
Thanks. Thanks for your time again, Wendy. That was fantastic.
All right. Thanks for having me.
So there you have it, folks. Our discussion with Wendy Waters, Vice President, Research Services and Strategy at GWL Realty Advisors.
Always a pleasure having Wendy in
the
studio.
What is the smart money thinking?
Yeah, exactly. And that might be the title. We'll see.
Yeah.
But here's the thing about Wendy Waters is that I always feel like I take talking points that I use in my life from conversations with her.
Yeah.
And the way it always kind of recalibrates how I'm thinking about things, because she, you know, there's things that are always like the takeaways are kind of almost fundamental. But anyways, what else do we have? First of all, there is a data dump happening.
Oh, right.
LinkedIn.
There is a data dump. So Wendy brought in a bunch of graphs and data with her. She's actually going to put it up. She started putting up some of the information she brought into the studio on LinkedIn. So go over and follow Wendy on LinkedIn. And she's a great follow, but if you're interested in seeing the data she was citing, definitely check her out there.
Yeah. And also, I should say, we have some amazing episodes coming up in the very near
future. Oh yeah, we're stacking
future.
Them. I feel like it's almost like you them through the summer.
Yesterday, Andrew List was in the studio.
Yeah.
Which
Chad Borman was in the other day.
Chad Borman was in a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
On Friday, we got Andrei Pavlov, professor in the business school at BD School of Business at SFU. It's just getting better and better and better.
It is.
And a lot of kind of perennial guests that are...
We're bringing back the hits.
We're bringing back the hits, but also it's like, the market feels a little bit different.
We haven't
right
talked
now.
To them in a while, which
and
is nice. Yeah, it's like a totally
nice
different
to circle
moment.
Back, right?
Exactly, exactly. What else do we have for the day, Adam? We have VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. Head over to VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com for all things real estate related, including the live wire. This is the weekly mailer where you get VIP pre-sale access. You get deal of the month. You get stats, different types of stats. Andrew List's stats, of course, from Greater Vancouver Realtors. He's the economist, but also sales ratio where you can dive into neighborhoods and different price bands. There's no reason why you shouldn't be on the live wire. And of course, we also have private client services.
Yeah, Matt. And if you are not using PCS, you are standing still while the rest of us power walk by. You get sold prices, days on market. You basically get realtor level information for free. It's available at your fingertips over at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. There's no reason why you shouldn't be monitoring the market with sold prices right now. This is the way to do it. There is, you know, we just had this conversation with Andrew List. There is some price discovery happening in certain markets.
Right.
And you want to be the person that's seeing those shifts, right?
You want to be discovering.
Well, exactly. And this is especially if you're looking at certain pockets in the region for condo product and there's a lot of inventory hanging around. see where those sales happen because certain buildings are being reset right now.
Absolutely. Absolutely. If you want to talk about that or anything else, you can try me at any time, 778-847-2854 or Matt at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Or you can try myself at 778-866-4574 or Adam at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
And of course, we have that Kokomo line, info at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Yeah, Scooter Blues, taking care of my blues on my scooter here. That's the Kokomo line. And Matt, I guess we're back here next week with another great episode.
We are. Stay tuned. We'll see you next week. And thanks for listening.
Take care.
2,000 Faces for Radio. Subscribe today.